This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the literary world, it was somewhere between a rumor and an open secret that the writer Anatole Breuer was a light-skinned black man passing for white. Breuer wrote a couple of terrific memoirs. Kafka Was the Rage was about living the bohemian life as a young man in Greenwich Village after World War II. Intoxicated by My Illness was about the end of his life when he was dying of prostate cancer. Breuer was also a longtime book critic and columnist for the New York Times. He kept his racial identity a secret from his two children. When he was dying, they knew he had a secret, but they didn't find out what it was until very close to the end when their mother told them. Anatole Breuer's daughter, Bliss Breuer, is my guest. She's just written a memoir called One Drop about learning his secret when she was 24 and how that secret changed her life. Her book also investigates her father's life and Creole heritage and reconstructs his family tree. In today's New York Times review, Janet Maslin wrote, "This fascinating, insightful book makes clear that Mr. Breuer left a legacy of racial confusion and great autobiographical material." Let's start with a reading from One Drop, describing how Bliss Breuer's mother revealed the secret.
"I think I better tell you what the secret is," my mother said. She was sitting between my brother Todd and me. We caught eyes behind her back. Inexplicably, we both began to grin. "Well," she took a breath and let it out, "your father's part black." I burst out with a laugh. "That's the secret? Daddy's part black? That's all?" Todd asked. "That's it," my mother said, allowing herself a smile. "We asked a few questions. How black was he? After all, he didn't look black. Neither did his sister Lorraine or his mother, whom we'd seen once or twice when we were little." My mother explained that my father had mixed blood, and his parents were both light-skinned Creoles from New Orleans, where race mixing had been common. She said that his parents had to pass for white in order to get work in 1930s New York, which confused my father about what their family was or was supposed to be. He was the lightest child out of the three siblings, and the fact that his two sisters lived as black was one of the reasons that we never saw them. My mother said that when my father was growing up in Brooklyn, where his family had moved when he was six, he'd been ostracized by both white and black kids alike. The black kids picked on him because he looked white, and the white kids rejected him because they knew his family was black. He'd come home from school with his jacket torn, and his parents wouldn't ask what happened. My mother said that he didn't tell us about his racial background because he wanted to spare his own children from going through what he did. "So this means that we're part black, too," I said, taking in the news. I had always bought into the idea of the American melting pot, and now I was an example of it. The idea thrilled me, as though I'd been reading a fascinating history book and then discovered my own name in the index. I felt like I mattered in a way that I hadn't before. Todd was pleased, too. "What a great pickup line," he said. "I may look white, but I'm really Afro-American where it counts. The guys in my office are always giving me such a hard time about being so white bread." "Todd," my mother said, alarmed, "this isn't something you should be telling everyone. Anyway, you kids aren't black. You're white."
And that's Bliss Breuer reading from her new memoir, One Drop. What a confusing message to give you. You know, like, your father has kept the secret all these years that he's really black, and but you're really white. Could it be more confusing?
No. Well, I think it was equally confusing for my dad because he'd grown up around people like himself who were Creoles from New Orleans, light-skinned blacks, and then when his family moved to New York, apparently his father had sat the kids down in the living room and said that from now on they had to be white in order to for them to work in New York, where it was very hard to get a job if you were black in the 1930s.
You knew that your father had a secret, but you didn't know what it was until your mother broke the news a couple of months before he died. He was in the hospital. He knew he was dying, and he didn't want to talk with you about it. He didn't want to reveal the secret himself. Why not?
Well, I think he always intended at some point during his illness to tell us, but I think it was very hard for him to figure out what the right words would be. And I think after keeping a secret from your children for, you know, all of our life, in a way it was more the fact of having a secret than the news itself that was going to be hard to explain. So he said, my mom had kind of sprung it on him a couple of months before that, you know, we're gathered here together, you're going to tell the kids the news. And he had said that he needed to think about how to present things. And I remember his phrasing because it was so typical and kind of surprising. He said he needed to He wanted to order his vulnerabilities so they didn't get magnified during the discussion. So I think that he had a lot to fear during this conversation, what we would think of him, whether it would change the way that we thought of ourselves, and, you know, that we'd be angry that we'd been kept from his family and this history for so long.
Were you angry?
I was angry. I mean, when I found out the actual news, I had just witnessed my father suffering terrible pain in the hospital. He'd been crying out, you know, help, like he was drowning. It was unbearable to listen to someone that you love suffer like that. So in that moment, I felt relief that the secret wasn't something more disturbing. Like, we thought perhaps he'd been the victim of some crime or there had been incest or something terrible. And so this seemed pretty lighthearted. By the time of his memorial service a month later, and that's where I met my father's sister, Shirley, and my cousin Frank, and saw his other sister, Lorraine, for the first time in 17 years, it started to dawn on me that this was more than just kind of an interesting note in his biography. And I did feel angry because as much as I wanted to reclaim that family and this history that I never knew, it was hard to start all of that at age 24.
Even though your father kept his racial identity a secret, a lot of his friends knew about it, even though his children didn't. And for years, there was speculation in the literary community about, was he really black passing for white? And your father was so well known, not only because of his books, but because for years he was a literary critic for the New York Times. And so there was a lot of speculation, you know, was he passing because he was ashamed to be black? Was he passing because it would improve his life and his family's? And the lives of his family members if he passed? Was he secretly racist? There was just all this speculation. So looking back now on your father's life, knowing what you know as a result of all the family history and genealogy that you did, what ideas do you have about how he felt about his racial identity as a black man, which he kept hidden?
My thoughts about why my father, or his feelings about his own racial identity, I think were very confusing for him. One of the indications I have of that is he'd filled out a Social Security application for a Social Security number when he was 17. It's the first record and one of the only records I have of him marking down his own race. And there's a check next to Negro, and then when that's crossed out, and then another check next to white, and then in the space other, there's a C, which could have stood for colored or Creole. So I think for him, it was an ongoing question about his own racial identity. I think that, you know, there's a fine line between kind of self-preservation. I think for him to live the life that he wanted, he didn't feel that he could do that as a black person. But then also selfishness, that he wanted to make up the rules, you know, as he went along and not have to live by these accepted society rules, the one drop rule, which said that he was a black person. So I think he did it for a lot of reasons, some to kind of protect himself and some to have the life that he wanted.
Your father in the 1940s was a bohemian, and he has a great memoir about his life in Greenwich Village in the 40s called Kafka Was the Rage. And, you know, it's all about, you know, like reinventing himself as his friends did too, and all of the kind of sexual adventures that he had and how important sex was to his life then. And, you know, even though he didn't reveal that he was, you know, black or Creole in the memoir, he revealed so many things about himself. And because, you know, like reinvention is so central to the whole idea of bohemian life then, where is that line, do you think, in his life between the reinvention that he thought everybody, the self-reinvention that he thought everybody should have a right to go through, and this kind of denial of who you really are?
I think that he probably fell more on the side of he thought everybody, like you say, had a right to self-invention. I mean, he wrote in Kafka Was the Rage that they all of his friends fled to Greenwich Village where, you know, nobody had a family. They were all sprung from their own brows and people's backgrounds. They were all trying to escape their backgrounds. And that was very much, you know, the moment in Greenwich Village after World War II when people were doing that. So I think for him, he you know, he really didn't feel like he had a responsibility, again, living in the way that sort of society had dictated to him, that he could live by his own rules.
One of his friends, Chandler Brassard, who'd also been living the bohemian life in Greenwich Village in the 1940s, later wrote a novel about that period. And one of the characters in the novel was based on your father, Anatole Broyard. And, you know, that character was a black man passing for white. The publisher sent your father a release form getting his permission for the character to be based on him, and your father was outraged. He refused to sign the form, so the character had to be changed as a result. And you say that your father felt betrayed, and that by singling out his racial identity, Chandler Brassard had made him an exception to the prevailing credo that they were all free to discover themselves without being encumbered by family or ancestral histories. And that in Chandler Brassard's formulation, your father wasn't inventing himself like everyone else. He was just pretending to be something that he wasn't.
Well, exactly. There was a kind of a special situation for blacks, that everyone else was invited in Greenwich Village, certainly, to take as much of their history and have that be as part of their lives as they wanted to. You know, I know people who were Jewish, but that wasn't from that era, but that wasn't particularly important about them, and it wasn't made to be important about them by their friends. And in my father's case, however, Brassard, in writing Who Walk in Darkness, seemed to suggest that, no, if you're black, you have a responsibility to be out. And my father greatly resented it and refused to sign the release. And as a result, Brassard had to change it. And he changed it to the main character was illegitimate, which, of course, didn't carry the same kind of social stigma in the 1940s as being black did.
You write that your father truly believed that there wasn't any essential difference between blacks and whites, and that the only person responsible for determining who he was supposed to be was himself.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it was very kind of easy for my father to feel that way because the world didn't see a black man when they looked at him. He wasn't reminded of it constantly, you know, in stores or in restaurants being refused service, which happened to a lot of his friends from the neighborhood who were darker skinned. So I think it was naive on his part to think that he could just, a black person could reject all the kind of assumptions and stereotypes that white people often thought when seeing a black person. Brassard's kind of assumption that my father had to be black.
My guest is Bliss Broyard. Her new memoir is called One Drop. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bliss Broyard, and her new memoir, One Drop, is about her father, the literary critic and memoirist Anatole Broyard. And she found out when she was 24 that her father was really black, passing for white. And that's at the heart of this memoir. There were things that your father said that really that you quote in your memoir that make the reader wonder. You know, was your father perhaps racist? I mean, you describe how he was worried when black people started moving onto your block that they were going to bring down the price of your home. He sometimes used the word jigaboo. There are other instances like that you cite. Do you think that there was a racist aspect to your father or a self-hating aspect to your father?
Well, I think it was probably a little bit of both. I think that he felt angry at the existence of blacks. He sort of blamed them for the existence of racism rather than white people. And he, for example, the example that you cite about worrying about our house in Connecticut, you know, what he had seen happen in Bedford-Stuyvesant is when during the Depression, when a lot of blacks started moving into the neighborhood, the housing properties dropped. And so rather than seeing that as a really kind of a complicated societal problem, he just blamed blacks for bringing down the neighborhood. So I think it was both racism and self-hatred.
When you found out that your father was really a very light-skinned African-American, it meant that you not only had to revise your sense of your father's identity in his life, but of your own. And when your mother told you and your brother your father's secret, she said, "This isn't something you should be telling everyone. Anyway, you kids aren't black, you're white." So what do you think? Like, how do you define your racial identity when anybody asks you to, whether it's a forum or a conversation? How have you come to think of yourself racially?
Well, it sort of depends on the circumstance. Usually for a forum, I would say black, white, check all that apply, which we are now able to do since 2000. So in my case, it would be black, white, and Native American. In conversation, I used to really struggle over how to answer the question because I felt that if I said biracial or black, white, that there might be some expectation that I would seem more black in some way. I felt in the beginning that there was some kind of right answer out there, that I could put the circumstances in my life, you know, raised as a WASP for 23 years, learned this information at 24, met this many family members, knew this much about history, and come up with a succinct answer of my own identity. And it's a lot more complicated. You know, there isn't one right answer. So I think I'm sort of more interested in, I think that now that I've learned a lot about my history and met my family, I feel more comfortable with who I am and less concerned about how I represent myself. But the short answer would be, I say I have mixed race ancestry.
As you say, it was an open secret among people who knew your father well outside of his children, that he was black. But he was officially outed in a New Yorker article by Henry Louis Gates a few years ago. And Gates had actually had several long conversations with you, although you didn't know that he was writing or that he would eventually write a piece about your father when you talked with him about your father. What impact did Henry Louis Gates's article about your father have on you and your family?
Well, at first I was really upset about it, as he knows. I think I really had this idea that because I didn't have control over this information as a child, I wanted to take control over it by being the one who outed my father. Now I'm really grateful that I didn't have to take on that responsibility. I think that, again, I had this idea that I could, you know, write a 1,000-word essay, or I somehow could come up with a statement that would encapsulate the struggle that he had over his racial identity and explain it. And I think it was very hard for me to do that. So I think that Gates kind of gave me something to respond to, and got the information out there. I mean, I told friends ever since I'd known, but the act of a kind of a public outing, I think, required a sort of drama that I'm glad I didn't end up getting engaged in.
Would you say that he got the story right?
I think that the Gates article was very perceptive about the notion of passing in general, and kind of questioning, you know, what is an authentic identity, and framing my dad's struggle in a lot of the modernist themes of reinvention. But I think that I would have liked to see more about my father's background as a Creole, because I think that that's the thing for me that was the missing piece that explained his separation, for example, in Bedford-Stuyvesant from the kind of larger black kids that were there. And they had always, his family, even within the black community, had kind of kept themselves separate. And I would have liked to see that in the piece as well.
Your memoir opens when your father is dying of prostate cancer that had metastasized. He wrote a great book about his final illness called Intoxicated by My Illness. He writes, "All my friends are wits, but now that I'm sick, I'm treated to the spectacle of watching them wear different faces. They come to see me, and instead of being ironical and making jokes, they're terribly serious. They look at me with a kind of grotesque lovingness in their faces. They touch me, they feel my pulse almost. They're trying to give me strength, and I'm trying to shove it off. The dying man has to decide how tactful he wants to be. What a critically ill person needs above all is to be understood." Were you self-conscious around him because he had this sense of what dying meant and how a dying person should behave and how his friends and family should behave? I'm not sure how much he actually communicated that. And I'm also not sure how self-conscious that would make you, that you had to behave according to his code. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think that the moment that comes to mind is right before my father had this emergency surgery. My mother had called my brother and me and told us to come to the hospital, and she had to go off with some doctors to sign some forms, and she wanted me to stay in the room with him. And he was in a terrible crisis. He was in a lot of pain. He looked like he was in shock. And I thought that I was probably never going to see him again. That's what the doctors had kind of led us to expect. After the surgery, he wouldn't necessarily make it. And so I tried to say goodbye. And he kind of kept looking at me, and I pulled my chair closer and was whispering, you know, the things that you say to someone if you think they're dying, that I loved him, that I was proud of him, that he had lived a good life. And he told me to stop with my bromides, that this was incredibly difficult and that he needed to concentrate. And it's funny to me because he wrote a wonderful story about his own father's death, what the cystoscope said, where, you know, he sat at his father's bedside and said a lot of those same things, and it's a very beautiful and moving scene. So I think that my father did welcome those sentiments, but the articulation of them, perhaps because, you know, they do come out in kind of cliche language, you know, embarrassed him or troubled him.
Well, Bliss Broyard, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Bliss Broyard's new memoir is called One Drop. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.